We are doing a Bible survey, as you know if you were here last week. The big sort of proposition of my plan is that we want to get the big picture clear. That's number one goal. We talked about puzzles last week, and if you really want to succeed at a puzzle, you could look at all the details, and if you are really good at the details, you will eventually make progress, but it's really hard, really uncertain. The more reliable way is get a good, clear view of the box and work accordingly. And then the interesting thing is that there's certain parts of the Bible that really give you a box view. So Revelation 4:11 is one verse we looked at. There's a whole bunch of major biblical texts that show you the whole message of the Bible in one go. Creation, fall, redemption, consummation, and it all fits together. And in a way, it's like there's a little puzzle piece and it's got a miniature version of the box on it, so you can look at the puzzle piece. So it has its place in the puzzle, but it also shows you the box. We're going to keep looking at the box, and we're going to look at it in a bunch of different ways. Today we're going to look at the history of the box, or the dates on the box. That's the idea. What are the big dates? So the bad news about learning history is you have to know some dates. Everybody hates that. I confess, actually, maybe it's my old age, I'm getting more and more comfortable with being interested in dates. I'm like, whoa, which date was that? I want to know. When I was a kid, of course, I went along with the, oh, history is all full of dates. But now I'm like, give me more dates. I actually really read a really interesting article on the dates of the book of Samuel. And this guy did a really, really careful study of each little moment in the book of Samuel and built this timeline of every little thing. And there's all these really interesting things you learn that way. Like, for instance, how much older do you think Jonathan was than David? Or what do you think their relative ages were?
5 years.
5 years difference, something like that?
20 years.
20 years? Yeah, something like, okay. It's between 30 and 40 years different.
Wow.
Yeah. So Jonathan would have been like really reaching his almost, like, he's got to become king soon or he won't have much time left to reign. And David is just in his 20s, right? And the way you know that is not because anywhere in the text gives you that information exactly. It's that Jonathan was fighting a battle before David was born. But you have to do all these, like, you have to do a lot of work to sort of get the comparative date right. But it really changes the scene when you realize, whoa, Jonathan is really giving up his crowning life achievement to David when he's been waiting to be king for years and years and years and years. All of a sudden this young buck comes in and God anoints him, and David's like, sure, if he's God's king, I'll give him my royal garments. That'll be fine. Point is, dates can be more interesting than we let on. So that's my disclaimer. Yep.
I think if you look at it personally, and this helped me with dates, kind of, is that, or it does, if I look at it that way.
Uh-huh.
I used to think World War II was ancient history.
Yeah.
Until I realized I was born 7 years after it ended.
Yeah.
So dates,
yeah,
if you look at them personally, can help.
Yeah, current events suddenly becomes history. And, you know, all of a sudden you have kids who are, like, learning about the 90s, and you're like, hey. That's how some of you feel about different decades, yeah. So anyways, you don't have to be super interested in dates, but if you are, you can keep going down this path as long as you want. There's lots of dates in the Bible. But I think it's enough if you know six. Six dates, and you don't even have to know exact dates. You can round them to the nearest century, and it's good enough. It doesn't really matter that much. You don't have to remember which month of which year. You just sort of remember some big dates. So obviously, it'd be nice to have an exact date for creation. Does anyone know James Usher's date for creation? He studied all the genealogies. This is the
4500 BC.
Close. It's 4004 BC. Yeah, yeah. And I remember when I was a kid on TV, the news had a little segment in the year 2004. They mentioned this and said, "Congratulations! You know, we've reached our 6000th year." But what did they get wrong?
Zero.
That's 6008.
Yeah.
Because it's backwards. Like they anyways, they just looked at 2004 lined up with 6004, but they should have shared that factoid in 1996. That would have been right. Anyways,
the news.
BC and AD.
Historians don't include zero, though, I think.
Well, there is that too.
One BC straight to 180.
Right, right. There's so many. Yeah, there's a good. I think it's a Far Side comic where.
No, but that makes it accurate, right? Because otherwise you would have to go 1 year before.
No, you go from 1 BC to 1 AD.
Oh, man.
Right, it's 1 year.
I didn't have to worry about people not liking dates.
You have to be a good mathematician, do you?
You do, unlike the people on Global News in BC. Yeah. There's a good Far Side comic where somebody's like writing in 300 BC on a coin. You know? And of course, the more you think about that, the more you realize that's not possible. Anyways, the point is that creation is where it starts, okay? God made the world by his supernatural power. He judged the world with a flood in the days of Noah, and that's the first 11 chapters of Genesis. And, you know, there's a lot of years there, probably at least 4,000 in there, and you can add up all the genealogies and so on and kind of try to make it exact. I have no reason to think Usher's wrong about 4,004. That's just one person's research. So then... the first date that's really something we can pinpoint is Abraham. He lived about 2,000 years before Jesus. And this is kind of a good thing to keep in mind, is that from the first mention of Abraham in Genesis 11 to the end of Genesis when Abraham's grandson Jacob dies, that's about 200 years of history. So in a way, you have 11 chapters covering 4,000 years or so, and then you have 39 chapters covering 200 years. That's kind of interesting why the proportions are like that. Then between the end of Genesis and the beginning of Exodus is about 300 years. So there's a long historical gap there where the Israelites are in Egypt in slavery, and then Moses is born, and of course Exodus, we're off to the races again. One little note is Job probably lived around this time. We don't know for sure. Has anyone ever heard this idea that Job may have lived around the time of Abraham? It's something that I had heard generally several times. There's one very interesting article written by a guy called Jim Jordan who wrote a two-part study of this. And he basically thinks there's a lot of reasons to believe that Job is an Edomite king. So Edom was the nation that descended from Esau. And in Genesis 35, I believe, there's a list of the kings of Edom, and one of them is named Jobab. And basically, when you really look at details, he builds quite a case that could be the same figure as Job in the Bible. So that's roughly the historical context for the book of Job in all probability. It's almost certain that Job was Edomite anyways, because one of his friends' name is Eliphaz the Temanite. And Teman is one of the other Edomite kings. So that region, Teman, if you're a Temanite, you're in that part of the world and you're in that part of the human family. So that's a little bit about the historical context of Genesis. So Abraham's 2000 BC. Major empires and things of that time, does anyone know, you paid attention in your ancient civilizations classes in history?
Maybe Egypt is the big ruler?
Egypt was one of them, yep. Mm-hmm. Abraham probably was contemporary with ancient Sumer. There's an even older empire. Sumer is like where the first writing that we have historical records of comes from. And that's probably the background in Ur of the Chaldees. There's this empire there in the Fertile Crescent. So, but yeah, Egypt is certainly going to be the big one in the next date, which is... Moses. So Moses lived 1500 BC. We're rounding again, but we're not rounding that much. It's like 50 years rounding, not hundreds of years rounding. There's an alternative date of the Exodus that puts it at 1200 BC. And just to make a long story short, I've given you the correct date, okay? There's a whole bunch of reasons why the less you believe the Bible's true, the more you'll think the later date is right. And to be honest, I can't remember them all off the top of my head, so I don't want to summarize them. But the more you think the Bible's true, the more you'll think the year 1500 is a pretty good date for Moses. That's not to say everybody who believes in the 1200 date is a, you know, massive heretic or something, but I do think it's basically, anyways, I tried to put it as simply as I could. I just think I'm pretty comfortable with the traditional date is a little earlier, and the reasons for the later date are, I think, somewhat because people don't quite believe the Bible's correct. So there we go. So Moses is born around 1500. He was 40 years old when he completed his first career. He's a good example of, you know, those people who are always saying, well, you just need new skills, you know, learn to code or something if your first career doesn't work out. Moses' first career was Prince of Egypt. Anyone seen the movie? Yeah, our kids watched that movie a few weeks ago, and man, those songs, they really get stuck in the head. I look at my life through heaven's eyes now and again when I remember to do so. Moses was 40 when he decided that he was going to join the Hebrews, and this very significant choice that he made to throw in his lot with the Hebrew people as opposed to being one of their Egyptian oppressors. And then that launches his second career, which is another 40 years. And he has a family and he has flocks. And then at the end of that 40-year period, he ends up at a bush and he meets God. And that launches career number three, which also lasted 40 years. And that's an easy way to remember Moses. And he died at the age of 120, unlike the rest of us, even in our 30s or 40s, undiminished in vigor, the Bible says. So what a guy. So that covers Exodus to Deuteronomy, those four books of the Bible. The events in those books are all in the lifetime of Moses. Of course, Genesis was written by Moses, so in terms of their writing, they all date to that period. But the events of Genesis are earlier. The next period in history is basically the conquest of the land under Joshua, and then the judges rule over the people as a federation of tribes. Pretty loosely organized, but spiritually united by the fact that they were bound to worship God at the tabernacle. And the judges is one of those tumultuous periods of history where nothing seemed to be going right, either politically or spiritually. A key transition moment happens under Samuel. He's the last judge, and he really is one of the first men who fits the bill of a prophet in the sense that we're more familiar with from later prophets. Moses was a prophet. Abraham is called a prophet, but they're pretty different from somebody like Isaiah or Jeremiah or Ezekiel when you think about just their daily life and their work and everything. Samuel, I think, is the first in that line of men who really had this prophetic role more in a more clear way. But he's also the last judge, and that's pretty clear too, because he assembles the tribes and he does things that people like Gideon did, Samson did. Samuel is a very key transitional figure. And there's the very important moment in 1 Samuel 8 when the people demand a king, and God gives them what they want, and they get what they asked for. They get a king, and boy, it didn't go according to plan. Or it did go according to plan, but their plan was a bad one. But then God turned evil for good, because when they asked for a king, they were thinking, we want a king like all the nations, those evil kings who have absolute rule over their people. But then God, through the career of Saul, raised up David and gave them a different kind of king than they could have asked for, a godly king under God's law with not absolute rule over the people, but with a role of mediating God's law to the people and governing them in his name. So God turned evil for good in that way. Yeah, Kevin?
Sorry, going back a bit, during the time of Judges, I forget, were the Judges, did they unify roughly the 12 tribes of Israel, or were the 12 tribes kind of like more into like federated states as they did them? Were there civil wars between them during that time?
There were several, yeah. Yeah. And even when they were united, sometimes their union turned into civil war before the action was over. Yeah. You know how the kingdom broke into two later under Solomon's son Rehoboam? There's basically the northern part of the kingdom and the southern part. That basic fault line is between Joseph and Judah. The tribes of Joseph are Ephraim and Manasseh, Joseph's sons. They're the big tribes in the north, especially Ephraim. And Judah's the big tribe out of the 12, and it's in the south. And yeah, basically you can see over and over again, Judah and Ephraim are, they're a fractious pair of tribes. And those fault lines eventually break open under Rehoboam, but they're visible earlier as well in various ways. So that's a good point, yep. Yeah?
Just real quick, before the king, so during the reign of Judges, there were also priests, or these are kind of overlapping groups, or
yeah,
later, what's the...
Yeah, so the priests are instituted by Moses, and it's Moses' brother Aaron is the first one, the head high priest. And so there's sort of three grades of people who are responsible for the worship of the people. There's the high priests, and that's the specific line in a kind of firstborn line from Aaron. So there's one high priest at a time. And then around it, there's Aaron's sons who are priests. And then around them are the Levites, the whole tribe. And the tribe is organized into various departments with different responsibilities for things like moving the furniture of the tabernacle, and they have these practical divisions.
And that being the only thing that all the tribes have in common, does that give them kind of some political power? Are they contending with the judges a little bit, or just curious as well?
That's a good insight. You know, as an example of how the two could go together, Samuel was a judge. He also served as a priest because he grew up in the priest's house, Eli's house. And then Samuel, in his role as a prophet, criticized the priests because Eli's sons were very sinful. So you can see how there would be these contentions between priests, prophets, judges. They weren't all always synced up. Ideally, they would be, but certainly in actual fact, they weren't. Good observation. One other thing to notice is that the judges and prophets, that's not a hereditary office. There's no institutional backing. Just lo and behold, there's a prophet. No explanation. God just gives you one. Same thing with a judge. Samson is like born, and there he is. He's a judge. But he's born not to a family of judges. There's a whole story about his birth in Judges 9. And it's a woman who couldn't conceive, and she has a miracle child, and Samson is the child she has. Point is, there's no hereditary line. Whereas for priests, there is a hereditary institutional aspect to it. So you could know growing up, I'm going to be a priest when I grow up. And that did mean that they tended to have a more institutional, bureaucratic is too negative a word, but they had this institutional aspect to their ministry, and often institutional corruption. And then prophets, they would come and go, like Elijah would show up and like, hey, priests and kings, you're doing a bad job. And that's just a very different type of ministry. Yeah. So that is one of the things that you see all the way through the Old Testament is prophets having a kind of critic role of the institutional leaders. In church would be priests, in state would be kings. So that church-state distinction is still there. Under the priests and under the kings. So that's my best effort to sort of summarize a perspective on that. So then we get David. David is born around the year 1000. Nice, easy, round number to remember. And David really is the main dude in the Old Testament. The more you read the Old Testament, the more you realize, man, David is like, he is the main person you need to know to understand the message of the Old Testament. After David, everybody's asking, when are we going to get David back? That's the big question. And that becomes the way people look forward to Christ coming, is when will we get our David? Now, David's son Solomon built the kingdom to its height. Solomon's erection of the temple is one of the few dates in Israel that we have external archaeological confirmation for. So just so you know how we get these dates, some of it is comparing inside the history of the Bible. And then there's a few dates where we get, you know, the Hittites mention something, or the Assyrians mention something, or the Babylonians mention something. Solomon's temple is one of those key anchor points in the chronology. So we know the date pretty well for that one. So the kingdom broke apart. We've already discussed that. There's the southern kingdom, which was ruled by a son of David. And the northern kingdom was ruled from a capital of Samaria by a lot of different royal families, one after the other. They kept falling and being replaced, and there were coups and all sorts of things. But the southern kingdom was marked by great stability politically. Both kingdoms were pretty bad, but the northern kingdom was worse. So least bad prize goes to Judah. And God exiled them to Assyria in about the year 720. So that's a seventh bonus date. I told you only six, but if you can manage seven, I would add the year 720. That's the year that the Assyrians defeated the northern kingdom. By the way, remember, they almost defeated the southern kingdom too. They surrounded the city of Jerusalem, and King Hezekiah had to stare them down. And that's all recorded in the book of Kings and also in the prophecy of Isaiah. Hezekiah's standoff with the Assyrians is in 720. If we just pause there, think about the books that have been written to this point. There's the books of Moses, then there's the book of Joshua and Judges, the books of Samuel record all this history, and we're right in the middle of the book of Kings. That's where we are in those history books. Not that many other parts of the Bible have been written. Moses wrote a few Psalms. The book of Ruth came from the period of the Judges, but the book of Job may have been written, although it's possible it was written by Solomon about this character Job from hundreds of years before. That's one theory of Job's authorship. But the point is, we don't yet have a whole lot of the parts of the Bible that we love. The book of Psalms is not written yet. We don't have...
Some are written, but they're probably not put together as a compendium.
That's true. Sorry, I have got a little ahead of myself in the sense I've got to the end of this section 4 about David. So if we go to if my mind catches up with me and we get to the year 720 BC, by that time we do have many of the Psalms. We have Solomon's Proverbs. We have Book of Ecclesiastes, Song of Solomon. We've got Job. We've got Genesis to Kings, mostly. That tail end of Kings needs to be written yet. We've got the prophecy of Isaiah and some of the other prophets. So for instance, Joel is probably written, Hosea, and... Daniel would be after, he's in the next section. Yeah. So, yeah, we're, maybe one way to summarize the point I'm making is that a lot of the Bible was written under point 4. That's kind of what I'm getting at. A huge amount of the Bible was written at the time of David and immediately after. There's a big cluster of books. And then the next point, 5, the year 600 BC. This is another one easy to remember, and we're not rounding by much. And it's the Babylonian exile. The exile actually happened in three stages. This is one of my favorite little memory things about remembering Bible facts, is the three men, Daniel, Ezekiel, and Jeremiah, you can remember they were each affected by the three stages. So the Babylonians showed up in stage 1 and had kind of exile 1.0. It was the smallest exile. And Daniel was one of the young men growing up with a royal family background, an aristocratic education. He was one of the nobles. And they took away some of the gold and they took away some of the best people. And Daniel and his friends were among those highly educated youths who they took. And so he ends up in Babylon as a young man, and actually would have been somewhat lonely in Babylon. There weren't, you know, most of the rest of the people were back home in Judah. Some years later, there's a second exile. We could get into all the details, but it's really tricky to remember which king did what and who was related to who, how, and all that. It gets really detailed at this point. And in that second exile, Ezekiel is captured. And Ezekiel, he was a priest, or he was going to be a priest, and he opens his prophecy saying, in the 30th year, meaning this prophecy began when I turned 30. Turning 30 is when a priest would be ordained to his ministry. And God made that the moment when Ezekiel entered his ministry as a prophet, almost as a, you might think of it as a sort of compensation. Ezekiel had a prophetic ministry in lieu of the priestly ministry that was taken away from him by the Babylonian exile. And then, again, some years later, there's a third wave, And I say Jeremiah is captured in this third wave. Really, the focus of the book of Jeremiah is about this final... Jeremiah's prophecy runs through all three of these, but it comes to its climax in the days before this final destruction. And he writes the book of Lamentations after this final destruction, when the temple is burned to the ground and everything's really ruined. He would have been quite an elderly man by that point, so he really lived through all this whole period. Daniel and Ezekiel were younger than him. So that's another real crisis moment when a lot of the Bible gets written, is right at this this judgment in the Babylonian exile. And they spend 70 years in exile, and then the Jews begin returning to their land. And this is where we get some more books of the Bible written. Daniel, the book of Esther also chronicles this period. The books of Ezra and Nehemiah tell us about how some of the Jews returned to Jerusalem and Judah. And there are also various prophets writing at this period, ministering to God's people. For instance, the book of Haggai is written to encourage people who are rebuilding the temple. That's a part of the Bible that's being written. So some of those later minor prophets, we call them minor not because they're unimportant, just because they're shorter. So those shorter prophet books, some of them come from that period. And then we have 400 years gap. So Malachi, the last book of the Bible in the Old Testament, is written around the year 400. And there's actually a lot that happens in the next 400 years to Judah. There's a whole history of the Greek invasion of this part of the world. Alexander the Great takes over this whole region all the way from Greece to India. Then one of Alexander's captains, basically Alexander's kingdom splits into four. And one of them, the Seleucids, are very negative about the Jews, and they capture the temple. And there's this whole background. And this is the period where some of the New Testament things that we meet in the Gospels, we get the background to it. So for instance, the Pharisees started around this time. In the crucible of the suffering under the Greeks, the question was, how do we stay faithful Jews? And the Pharisees' answer was, we keep rules even harder than ever before. Right? So the Pharisees actually were like the serious believers of the intense suffering period under the Greeks. The point is we can skip over that history because there's no books of the Bible written, but it doesn't mean nothing was happening, okay? So it's the silent years in the sense that there's no prophets, but if you'd been living at that time, you know, things were still going on. You still needed to trust the Lord during that period.
Isn't that the Hanukkah story? And the
Michael's pointing out, isn't that the Hanukkah story? Yes.
And the Maccabees.
That's right.
Those are tremendous heroes, and they're representative of the force of God, because that's how they triumph. And that's why the candles, the oil is still in the lamps and still lights. So it's not like God has completely abandoned them.
Right, yeah. So the whole theology of Hanukkah and everything, the key thing is that it's not based on biblical revelation the way other Old Testament feasts were. That doesn't necessarily mean it's a wrong thing to have developed, because, you know, birthdays are not in the Bible either, right? So we can have celebrations that are not in the Bible. But it's not comparable theologically to, say, the Day of Atonement or the Feast of Weeks or the Feast of Tabernacles, which are in the Bible.
That's right, yeah.
Another thing to know is that you may know that some churches use Bibles that have the Apocrypha in them. And the Apocrypha is really an interesting mixed bag of things, but it mostly comes from this 400-year period. And the key thing to know about the Apocrypha that helps us see that it's not part of the Old Testament is that none of it was written in Hebrew. So that's the big obvious difference from Malachi to the Apocrypha. The Apocrypha is all written in Greek, because during this period, the Greek Empire had taken over this part of the world. And so there's a very clear line from Malachi to everything else in the Apocrypha, where we have Hebrew originals for everything up to Malachi, and then there's no Hebrew original for the book of Maccabees or any of those things. The other thing you should know is the book of Maccabees is pretty great. It's good reading, good history. I think most of it's true, as far as I know. I haven't researched it carefully. But then there's also other things in the Apocrypha, like Bel and the Dragon.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, it's like ancient Disney. You know, it's just different. So just so you know, the Apocrypha is kind of a mixed bag. We shouldn't say it's all bad or worthless, but it's not part of the Bible. Some of it's historically interesting and valuable, and even spiritually quite inspiring, because indeed some of the Maccabees example is really noble example of spiritual courage in the face of persecution. So we don't want to despise it, but we also don't want to treat it as if it's scripture. So that's the correct and also Protestant view of the Apocrypha. So then, of course, we have Jesus' birth. Anyone remember this date? Was it zero, Pat, or was it one? Jesus is ironically actually born several years before Christ. It's like 4 BC or something. So that's one of those... I'm sure the guy who came up with that calendar system was really kicking himself in heaven about that. But this is just life. We don't always get our calendars right. And one thing I would just point out about the New Testament timeline is, you notice how short it is? Within 100 years, at the longest, the entire New Testament is written. None of it probably started being written until the year 48 or so. So really within 50 years, and actually, I think there's good reason to think most of the New Testament was written, maybe all of it, before 70 AD, when the temple was destroyed. It's hard to be sure about that, but different people attach different significance to that question. But basically, it could have been written in 20 years. What do you think? It's possible. No, for sure. But it could not have been written in longer than 50 years. That's the longest possible window. And again, if you ever hear somebody saying, oh yeah, the book of John came from the year 150 or something, and they have a much later view, that's because they don't believe the Bible's true. It's not because they have good evidence. It's just, they just don't think people could predict things in advance and stuff like that. So that's quite different from the Old Testament. 1,000 years of writing the Old Testament, and then, boom, 20 years, one generation, you got your New Testament. I think that shows a huge difference between the two. And it also shows the amazing significance of the apostolic period, that God really put a capstone on biblical revelation in a way that brings the Old Testament message to completion and fruition, all in one dramatic flourish. So the ministry of Christ and the apostles is really an amazing package that completes the message of the Bible. I did give you on the back some reference material, just because I love you, and you know, it's always good to be able to look at these things instead of having them in memory. At the top is just my little typed out summary of when I think these books of the Bible were written. There's not a lot of super duper careful research there. Some of it's pretty obvious. Some of it's a little bit disputed. Like, for instance, the book of Joel, nobody really knows when it was written, and not really anything significant attaches to the question. Was it written in the 800s or the 700s? It's not very important. Other books, like for instance, Isaiah, when people say the book of Isaiah was written in the 500s, that is theologically important, because what they mean is that Isaiah could not have predicted the exile in advance, so he must have been living after the exile, right? So that it is actually really important that the book of Isaiah was written in the 700s. But basically, just believe what I say, and all those numbers are right, okay? That's my little summary. And then I gave you a little New Testament timeline. I actually put the link because I found this link in a few minutes of Googling, and it had way more dates than I could fit on one page, and I found it, as I admitted at the beginning, quite interesting, and I thought you might find it interesting too. But you can see James is probably written in the 40s, maybe mid-40s. Paul probably wrote Galatians around the year 48. And then John died around the year 100, and his letters and his gospel are at the very latest in the 90s. So that's a generation of amazing quantities of biblical revelation happening all at one time. So that's a little summary. Okay, so there's our dates. I think having dates clear is going to help understanding how the Bible fits together. Especially, is it before or after Moses? Is it before or after David? Is it before or after the exile? And is it before or after Jesus? That's pretty pretty simple framework, and very, very useful for understanding how things fit together.